Coming up, Tom Cross joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hi, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
And very excited to talk to Academy Award-winning editor, our first editor, Tom Cross. Is going to be on the show, of course, edited La La Land.
Yay!
We love
La La Land.
My God, I've seen it so many times. I watched it even on the airplane. I was like, are you going to watch this one more time? And of course I did.
Sure.
Beautifully edited film.
Yes.
Editing is something I love. I've always, when I was a little kid, I remember making slideshows with you know, I'd find photographs and then find music. And I always had that natural affinity to know, you know, what the song was, and making mixtapes and things like that. It was always in my wheelhouse. And so
that's kind of amazing, I have to say, to even have an awareness of that when you're a kid, because I actually remember, this is my first memory of being aware of editing, was in Friday the 13th, the dog gets killed. Smash cut to them putting a hot dog on a grill.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So it was clearly a joke edit.
Right.
You know? And I remember afterwards having a conversation with my girlfriends and going, now that was intentional, right?
Yeah.
When I was a little kid, I had no sort of awareness about how movies were made, and I had no idea. Yes.
Thanks for catching that.
Thank you.
Start
okay. Up. Let me blow my nose before we go. Okay. Interesting.
We'll start from the. Let's start from the top.
Running.
And that one gets destroyed, right? It doesn't get accident. Okay.
Thanks, Ben. Okay. I am now ready. Okay. Coming up, Tom Cross joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hi, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas. I'm here with the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
And very excited to be interviewing our first editor. And I started at the top, Academy
you
Award.
You did.
Winning editor, Tom Cross. Of course, won an Academy Award for Whiplash and La La Land. We love La La Land. I've seen it many, many times.
Have you?
Yeah, I watch it. I even recently watched it on the airplane. I said, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm going to watch this movie again.
When you like something, you like something.
City of Stars. Da, 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 da. I love that. It's a wonderful film. But I love editing. And I always had a weird natural affinity for it. I love music. But one of my first, like, sort of crazy, no one asked you to do this, why are you doing this, performance pieces was I would take slides, I'd take photographs, and then play music with them. And I forced the school assembly. My first one was about pollution and air pollution and stuff like that.
So you were sort of doing a PowerPoint presentation, essentially.
Basically, yeah. So I take pictures of garbage and then use like Paul McCartney's song Junk, you know, and things like that.
And you time the
totally. It was completely.
You have always, I was like, always been a film nerd, haven't you?
Yes, I was always. So I did that, and then I was maniacal about making mixtapes. I would record people you know, if Vanessa Redgrave called me, then I'd like use that, and then I'd fade it into a song. So I just always had like a, it was something that I liked to do. And when I met Martin Scorsese on the dubbing stage of Last Temptation, it's interesting, that was my first, they were cutting, rapidly cutting the film because they needed it to go out because of this controversy.
A lot of that story here in this book.
That's true.
Your book, I Blame Dennis Hopper. It's so much of your life I find so fascinating with
like a movie.
It is. It's just like a more your life is more like a movie than anybody else I know. But I believe that too. I remember, you know, having like moments when I was a kid and going, this is just like being in a movie.
Yes.
But your life is really like being in a movie. And your book is about your life. About being in a movie. So people need to read that book.
Well, that was essentially, again, my introduction to the film business was behind the scenes. And I met Thelma Schoonmaker, you know, of course, now, again, considered one of the great editors of all time.
And she was almost always partnered with Martin Scorsese?
Yes, from the very beginning. They met when at NYU, and they've had, of course, an amazing collaboration. And she was on Last Temptation of Christ. And then when they started, they did New York Stories. And then, but by the time of Goodfellas, I was sitting in the editing room all the time, like just by Thelma. And she cut, she ended up cutting Grace of My Heart.
Aww.
And her amazing assistant editor, Jimmy Chu, cut a short film of mine. And what's so interesting about editing and about Thelma, and I'm going to ask Tom about this too, is I remember doing a short film and I had an editor working on it. And he said, I know you've got this thing where you want overlapping dialogue, but you really don't have the footage to support it. And he was so negative about what I had shot. And I remember taking all of the film. Thelma said, just put it in the car. And they were shooting Casino. And I was like, he hates my movie. He's not going to cut my movie. And Marty and Thelma said, just bring the entire film to Las Vegas. And I did. I drove to Las Vegas with cans of film. And I'll never forget the great Thelma Schoonmaker, you know, on a steam back, you know, rolling my, because it was actual film in those days. And we looked at it on the screen. She was like, there's nothing wrong with this. And I said, well, he says that doesn't match. And this, he says the eye line is wrong. And she's like, you flip it. And, you know, or you do this or you do that.
She had all the fixes.
Yeah. And it was so inspiring after that. And the same thing with Grace of My Heart. It's kind of like, you know, they love mistakes, and they really give me a lot of confidence in terms of, you know, there is no wrong answer. And sometimes subsequently when I was doing my web series and working with editors, you know, and they get into that, like, you don't have the footage.
Right.
You don't have the shot.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's something that Thelma never, she never just turned around and said, like, you're bad. You didn't get the right. There was always a way. You either, you know, there was some way artistically to make something even better out of something that was, you know, potentially a mistake.
Well, but I think that is somebody who is a master in their own craft and somebody who has an incredible amount of confidence in their work to be able to know that you can transform something like that. And certainly with editing, it does transform things because you can fix incredibly big mistakes. You know, you can, there's so much that can be done through editing.
Yes. They only had one, we disagreed about, a couple scenes that were in Grace of My Heart, and they did end up going based on, Thelma's and Marty's suggestions, but and Allison and I like them both, and we wanted them to be, so that's always like a heartbreaking thing as an actor when you know, you have to cut scenes. But I don't know. Some people, you know, as everyone knows, I'm obsessed with commentaries. And, you know, I like looking at scenes that didn't make it in the movie. I love listening to commentary. I garner amazing things out of it. And sometimes I look at a scene and I go, yeah, that definitely should have been cut. When I looked at The Burbs, you know, and our friend Joe Dante.
Yes.
And the scene, there was an alternate ending. And I did like the ending.
No, you liked the alternate better?
Yeah, the one he originally shot. I thought it was better. Sorry. Than the one that ended up in the movie. The one that ended up in the movie is a little more commercial, a little more slick. Another great example, if you want to look, I mean, this is textbook. Bad Santa was taken away from Terry Zwigoff and recut by Miramax. And he spent years delivering his original cut. And if you look at his version of Bad Santa is so similar to the follow-up of Ghost World. It's it's still funny, but it's not as wacky, you know? And who knows, maybe it wouldn't have been commercial, but if anybody ever wants to look at Terry Zwigoff's version of the cut, and then obviously the famous Miramax version of Bad Santa, you know, as an example of editing. You know, I love editing, though. Always, you know, it's amazing. I had so much fun in Trailblazing Women talking about editing, and we point out that Dee Dee Allen, 1967, kind of changed editing in terms of she introduced a lot of things into American cinema that then slow motion, which then they did in Wild Bunch, and what they call pre-lap, which is now every movie is pre-lap, meaning you hear the sound of the next scene before
the visual comes up.
Yeah, before you go into it. And now you're like, oh, well, that's, what are you talking about? That's a movie. that's, but
it was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah, at the time it was something that she did, or cutting something in the middle, or quick cutting. And so all these things are very interesting. For me, I think a seminal movie moment was probably, I remember seeing Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. And then I realized that the same editor had cut the same movie. And I was like, interesting. I started to hear this name, Dee Dee Allen. And I think that was like what I was like, I really liked. I was like, those movies, something about obviously Dog Day Afternoon, the cutting of that film. Oh, my God. It's just incredible. But then also Serpico, too, the way it. The emotional quality of that film, I remember. But anyway, we should let's bring in Tom Cross. Nobody wants to hear me talk about editing. Let's bring in an Academy Award winning editor. Look at him with his Oscar there. Of course, Tom has worked on projects such as Crazy Heart, The Switch, Emmy winning Deadwood, but he is best known for his work on the Academy Award winning film La La Land. And, of course, for his work on the other film, which he won an Academy Award, Whiplash. Please welcome Tom Cross, our first editor here. We'll cut all this. It'll be nice and smooth. Thank you. Nice for being here. Now you can wear the cans or not. It's up to you. I hear better with them. It's up to you.
You'll let me know if I have. Maybe I shouldn't. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
You sound fine. You don't need them.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, my God, I love this. Well,
and I love that you are part of Hollywood history, and you are a fan of Hollywood history.
Oh my God,
I love it.
I had no choice. I was on the set of being there when I was a little kid, so that kind of they talk about being indoctrinated. I was like, who's the crazy guy with the white hair? And, you know, that's what I always think is so amazing is, like, then I grew up and Hal Ashby ended up becoming, like, one of my favorite directors.
Right.
But at the time, I had no idea that there even was a director.
Right. And when I was a little kid, I mean, I should mention that the first movie that I saw, it's a little blurry. It's a little blurry.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing bits and pieces of things on TV. But the first movie that someone took me to was the movie Wages of Fear, the Clouseau film.
Yeah.
And it was at the public library in upstate New York, where I grew up, Rochester, New York. My dad took me to see Wages of Fear. He had seen it before, loved it. I'm not sure how he got the idea. I don't think he remembers this, but he took me to see that movie, and it kind of blew my mind. What blew my mind was, I remember there's this character, I forget who played him or what his name was, but he was Yves Montand's, like, sidekick.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the movie, he's, like, a total, he has this swagger, and he's very cocky and peacocky. And by the end of the movie, he's a sniveling, hurt, cowardly kind of piece of trash, you know? And just, I think I saw that when I was 6 or 7. I was just kind of, just seeing that character arc blew my mind. But, you know, you mentioned being there. Like, when I was a kid, we went to see a lot of movies for birthday parties, you know, Star Wars, Star Trek movies and stuff like that. For some reason, I think you may remember when it came out, but for some birthday party, it may have been my birthday party, we saw Being there. And I was like, you know, I was really little. And,
yeah.
And we took all these kids and we saw Being there. And I think it was because it was a Peter Sellers movie.
Yes.
And we had, the parents had had previous success taking the kids to see Pink Panther movies.
Yeah,
exactly. And so we saw Being there. But I still remember loving it. I loved the movie.
Yeah.
And that, you know, but I think a lot of my other friends, I mean, we were all kind of scratching our heads a little bit.
Yeah, I know. But some of it went over my head, too. Yeah, well, that's why I said, like, sitting across, you know, I knew Peter Sellers, of course, from Pink Panther, and he was so serious. And
yeah.
And just seeing him in real life, I don't know, it was my mind was blown immediately. So there are other movies that you always cite, I notice.
Right.
The French Connection.
Right.
And a highly edited film, of
yeah,
course.
I mean, The French Connection is something that I was too young to see it when it came out, but
right.
It was one that my parents were conscious of, and I saw it, you know, I saw it years later, I think on TV, or maybe I rented it or something like that, and it was hugely important to me. I mean, I actually remember being at home with my parents watching the Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and it was somewhere in the 80s, and they showed, to set up the Best Editing Award, they showed a clip from The French Connection, which was from a famous car chase.
Yeah.
And they tried to explain in a superficial Academy Award way what editing was. And first they ran the clip, and then they ran the clip again, and they had a counter on the screen to show you how many cuts there were.
Yeah.
And it was this kind of superficial explanation, but as a little kid or as a kid in high school or whatever, I was like, oh, I was starting to put two and two together. And I was equating editing with, I guess, the number of cuts, which is not a deep understanding. But I started to see that, oh, editing, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was definitely like a big, huge movie for me. And I noticed, you know, so I was getting into French Connection, and I started watching a lot of movies in the 80s. I went to the movies, mm-hmm. and I also rented tons of movies. And I tried to see everything, old, new, and I started seeing some of the same names pop up in movies, you know. So I saw the name Jerry Greenberg, who's an Academy Award-winning film editor. He cut The French Connection. He won his Oscar for that. I remember seeing his name on Apocalypse Now, and I think I went to the movies and I saw the De Palma movie Untouchables, and he was the editor of that movie.
Yeah.
And then Scarface, you know, De Palma's Scarface. And so I started putting it together, and other names I started to see, of course, Thelma Schoonmaker and Dee Dee Allen.
Yeah.
And that's when I started thinking, wow, there's someone behind all this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, I don't know why, but I was just fascinated. I think also the shower scene from Psycho.
Yeah. Have you seen the deck? I was in the deck.
No,
7852.
I'm dying to see that. I'm dying to see that. I haven't seen it yet.
I actually participated in the film. So,
oh, wow.
And I think that was my first. There was a great book called The Men Who Make the Movies, Richard mm-hmm. Schickel.
Mm-hmm.
And Alfred Hitchcock was explaining. I think that's when I was. He's like, you cut to them, then you cut back to the person, then you,
right.
you know, like trying to
explaining the mechanics of
exactly.
how it works. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And then you get closer.
Yeah.
And
Hitchcock was like an early influence of mine, because I do remember in the 80s, there was a time where there were a handful of Hitchcock movies that you couldn't see. Hitchcock had taken them out of circulation.
Yeah.
And they were Vertigo, Rear Window, I think The Man Who Knew Too Much, Troubled Harry, I forget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all
the color ones. And so around that time I was getting interested in movies. My father, those movies got re-released by Universal, and my father took me out to see them. And I remember that just, you know, I was getting really into Hitchcock. That just blew my mind. So I remember reading the Hitchcock Truffaut book, the famous book where it's Truffaut is interviewing Hitchcock, and I remember seeing TV documentaries about Hitchcock where he's talking about visual language, and
right.
got really into it.
Tension,
and just like the stress, as he put it, the stress on the pictorial so that you could appeal to the widest possible audience.
Right.
So it's like, cut to this shot, cut to that shot, everyone will understand it.
I think that those are one of the, I mean, that's actually one of the, in my own things where I've directed, that's one of the hardest things is tension.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nightmare. That and kissing scenes seem to be.
Kissing scenes. I'm trying to think if I've had to edit any kissing scenes or.
They're tough.
I mean, I guess there's in La La Land. There's, I mean, but it's not really. They're not really makeout scenes. They're just. It's just a kiss. So,
well, it's hard. You know, he looks and he looks and it can't. You know, it's got to be all. It's got.
That's right.
It's got to happen seamlessly with your mind.
Yeah.
I think. Well, that's what all editing is.
Yeah.
You know, because as you're watching the movie, you don't want anything. You know,
you don't want anything jarring.
A jump cut suddenly goes, oh, wait a minute, what happened?
What happened? Yeah, you know. Yeah. Well, they say that, you know, editing usually should be invisible, and that means it's good editing. But I was having a conversation with Alan Heim, the Academy Award-winning editor of All That Jazz.
Uh-huh.
Used to be Bob Fosse's editor. And brilliant editor. I'm such a fan of his. And we were talking about that, and he said, you know, he said, yeah, people say editing has to be invisible. Bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, he just called bullshit on that because he, you know, the work that he had done with Bob Fosse, Lenny, and Star 80, All That Jazz, I mean, it's the editing is anything but invisible. It's invisible when he wanted it to be.
Right.
But so many other scenes would get their tension or their, you know, this propulsiveness from feeling the edits, you know, and he knew that. And so, I don't know, so often editors talk about, you know, bad editing being noticeable, and he was pointing out that no, there's sometimes you want it to be noticeable.
Right. Well, we were talking before about the, and I mentioned this, we talked about this on the Trailblazing Women show, editing in Hollywood was, you know, there was Margaret Booth, and then I believe the other woman was Anne Beauchamp, I think may have been her name, but anyway, she worked with Cecil B. DeMille. I mean, I'm really going back.
Maybe Barbara McLean, maybe? Wait, let's see. Oh, Anne Bawkins.
Anne Bawkins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anne Bawkins, Academy Award-winning editor for, what did she edit? I think Northwest Mounted Police or something like that.
Something. But she worked with DeMille. But it was very much like it was this scene moved to the next scene and to the next scene. So everything was very very traditional.
Right. Very classical.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then that starts to change in the 60s, you know, with somebody like Dee Dee Allen where it's these things like, you know, we're saying pre-lap, slow motion, the end of Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, which was, even as a kid, I was like, whoa, what's happening?
What happened there? Yeah.
So that's very self-conscious.
Yeah, very propulsive. And that's what's so exciting to me is to see all of that, because I love watching old movies and all kinds of movies, and to see the different styles that happen. The classical style is so amazing in old Hollywood movies. But then, you know, then to see it start getting propulsive and different in the 60s, like I think of The Graduate as another huge favorite, right? Edited by Sam Osteen, who was also Roman Polanski's editor.
Yeah.
Sam Osteen cut Chinatown and
Rosemary's Baby.
You know. So, you know, that for me, you know, I can easily put on one of those movies, Rosemary's Baby, just watch it, and I'll just get pulled into it. And the funny thing is, even though I think I'm compulsive like a lot of editors, you know. I just get locked into details. When I'm watching a great movie, I don't notice the editing usually. I just get pulled into it. And something like Rosemary's Baby or even, you know, Casino, which is very propulsive. But I'll just get pulled into the story and the characters. So.
Now, Casino is an interesting movie because it's one of the movies we use for Thelma. I don't know why they picked that movie, but she does a thing which I find a little jarring, which is they do a jump cut dissolve right in the middle of a scene. They do it.
Right.
They've been going back to Taxi Driver. They do that.
Right.
And I remember when I was making movies, they'd always go, oh, you just dissolve in the middle of the shot. And it's like, but it's, you do notice it. Like he's going up the stairs and they just dissolve.
But in Casino,
they do it.
Yeah.
Constantly.
That's right. Taxi Driver, right? He's walking down 8th Avenue or something and they dissolve and he's closer, isn't that one of them too?
Yeah, they just
I forgot about that. Yeah.
And in Casino they do it a lot.
That's like, right.
They do.
There's a lot of little dissolves in Casino.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, all that stuff, I mean, all that language is so you know, can be so exciting. I mean, I have to say, I just saw a movie the other night. I saw this Noah Baumbach movie, The Meyerowitz Stories. Mm-hmm. And I know the editor and admire her work, Jennifer Lame. And and they did these wonderful things where they would, without giving away too much, they would, people would start talking and yelling at each other, and then it would cut abruptly in the middle of like a syllable, right, and cut to the next chapter. And it was done as a stylistic thing, and it was done with such wit that you know, you really felt that the editing was doing some heavy lifting, like it was really,
yeah,
supporting the comedy of it, but it was also like pointing out, like, wait, what did we just, you know, it's almost like if you're in a room with you know, siblings who are having a big argument, and all of a sudden you like run out of the room and shut the door, you're like, whoa, you
right,
know, look what I just came from. And that's what happened in the movie. There's also some jump cuts and some post-laps of, uh-huh, sound, which I know Scorsese did in After Hours, I remember.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was the first time he did it, but...
Yeah, I wonder. That I feel like that's hallmark, since I sort of went to the Thelma school. And
right,
we did a lot of that in Grace of My Heart.
Right.
Flash forward in the scene, go,
yeah,
back
go
to
back,
the scene.
Yeah.
There are no rules, you know.
That manipulation of time is something that is just, you know,
yeah,
I think... All those people we mentioned do it so well, I think.
My, yeah, favorite edited film is Two for the Road. Have you ever seen Two,
no,
for the Road?
No, Two for the Road is...
It's Stanley,
who directed?
Stanley Donen.
Okay.
And it's of 60s, but
okay,
it talks about this... It's like 10 years in,
right,
a couple. They meet, they marry, they divorce.
Right, okay.
They get back together. But it's got... It's the editing... I've seen this movie so many times.
Now I'm dying to know who edited the
yeah, I'm not sure, but it's Stanley Donen, who has,
okay,
a musical. He did Charade.
Yeah, of course. I love Charade.
So
yeah,
he has a real musicality, but like I've seen, I'm like, how did they do that? You know, where it's like they slam the car door and then,
right,
now they're 10 years ahead.
You're 10 years ahead, right.
Slam,
right,
the door, now they're back.
Right.
You know, and it's...
Yeah, that stuff, that transitional stuff, you made me think of, well, The Graduate with
oh my God, the
him
famous
jumping out of the pool onto Mrs. Robinson.
Amazing.
I read a story that Sam Osteen told that wasn't planned exactly that,
mm-hmm,
way, that it was something where they had to work out that transition, but they didn't know exactly how they were going to do it, and he's working with the film, and he came up with this thing, and he brought the film on set to show Mike Nichols, and,
yeah,
they were like, whoa, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like some of that stuff, those famous cuts, like the you know, in 2001 A Space Odyssey, the bone being thrown up in the air, and then
crazy,
you do that hard cut to the spaceship, or that that Ann Coates edited... moment in Lawrence of Arabia where Peter O'Toole blows the match out, and then we,
yeah,
cut to the sunset, and you
know it still seems like a trick. Like, how do they do that?
I don't know, but it's that stuff still, like, it's such confident storytelling that still blows my mind.
This,
you know,
is an aside, but you know that I was reading that Ann Coates, that they, I guess they cut Lawrence of Arabia down,
right,
at a certain point, and then
I think it got edited for its release, that like for length or something. Yeah,
yeah, and then he looked at it and she realized she kind of ruined it.
Right,
she said it plays long. It needs to play long.
Needs,
you
to
know,
play
like,
long.
It,
yeah.
So it, like, that's a form of editing too.
That's absolutely. I mean, we had some of that a little bit on La La Land. There's a scene where Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are later in the movie. They're having a dinner,
mm-hmm,
and they get into an argument.
Yes.
And Damien wanted that scene to play almost like another big set piece. You know, to him, that scene was as important as the Traffic set piece,
mm-hmm,
or the John Legend concert. He knew that it, just story-wise, it needed to be long and have, you know, to go through a certain amount of paces in order to have impact,
mm-hmm,
emotional impact. And so... You know, for that scene, which is very, you know, when you think of La La Land or Whiplash, when you think of Damien's movies, you don't necessarily think of that scene. You think of the sort of more propulsive, flashier scenes. But
right,
that scene was just as important to him. And for him, you know, he shot it with a bunch of different angles and things. But he put the challenge to me and said, look, you've got, I want you to use four angles, you know, a medium for each of, you've got a medium for each of them, you've got,
mm-hmm,
a close for each of them, and that's it. Just use that, because he knew that he wanted it stripped down and austere. He knew that if you started cutting all these other angles, it would be distracting.
Right.
He just wanted this stripped down scene where it's as if the characters can't even hide because this is where they're butting heads, and there's nowhere to go, there's nowhere to hide. So he said, cut in that medium, and when, you know, here's another rule: if you cut into close, you got to stay in close, can't cut out wide. So once you cut in close, choose that point wisely, and then just go into the closes. And you're allowed to use one insert shot, which is a needle, a record needle going into the run-out groove, and that's it. And I love challenges like that. And because I'm just, because what I've got are these very simple angles, but it's performance, and I love cutting performance. And I feel like I've been lucky with the projects I've done where we've had just fantastic performances. For me, that's where it all starts, you know?
So who trained you, like, when you got into editing?
Well, I went to SUNY Purchase Film School. After that, I moved to the city. I moved into New York, and I loved features. I always wanted to do movies, but I kind of had this real wandering route to film editing. I started in commercials, and I went to documentary and TV promos, industrials, fashion, everything, reality. And finally, I landed with I had several great editor mentors along the way. The one who was probably the biggest is a guy named John Axelrad, and I worked with him on five movies, two movies for director James Gray, We Own the Night and Two Lovers. And to work on those movies was a dream for me because I loved Little Odessa, which James Gray did, and The Yards. And after that, I assisted on Crazy Heart, the Scott Cooper movie with Jeff Bridges. And then I did two other comedies with this editor, John Axelrad. The Switch is Jason Bateman comedy, and Something Borrowed, a romantic comedy with Kate Hudson and John Krasinski. But that, you know, that was kind of my classical mentoring in a way. This was an editor who actually had assisted Ann Coates. He used to be one of Ann Coates' assistant editors. And so, you know, having that background, he really wanted to be a mentor himself and pass on, you know, what he knew. And so he would give me scenes to edit while I was assisting him. And he would look at my work, give me notes. He would even encourage directors to work with me. So some of them did, some of them didn't, you know. But it allowed me to get close to James Gray, and James and I became friends, and it allowed me to meet and get to know the director, Scott Cooper, who I ended up just doing a film with. So I owe a lot to John Axelrad, the editor, who really kind of took me under his wing. And not, you know, since everything switched over from film technology, you know, the apprenticeship of editors is very different than what it used to be. You know, when I was an assistant, I worked on film, and, you know, it was common to have the editor would have an assistant or apprentice right next to them, handing them trims, working with them directly. You'd be in the room for important meetings sometimes. Now that we edit digital, you know, the editor's pretty much alone.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because I was mentioning Thelma Schoonmaker's assistant editor, Jimmy Chu.
Jimmy Chu, okay. I've heard the name, but I don't know him. I know some of some people who have worked over the years have worked for her. But.
Yes. I remember lots of people came, and people ended up going for working for other people and everything. Yeah. But she always had people.
Someone with her.
Yeah.
That's always great. There are some editors, I think, because they,
like,
you know,
five or six people around.
Right. They remember what they went through, so they would have someone in the room. But usually, nowadays, they're not in the room itself. They're just in the room next door. You know, they're nearby, but they're not there. But, you know, when I was kind of up and coming and aspiring to, you know, work in Hollywood and do editing, I thought about, you know, stories I would hear about Dee Dee Allen. You know, editing with, you know, she had a lot of now famous editor assistants, Richard Marks, who, you know, cuts all of James Brooks's movies, Jerry Greenberg, Academy Award-winning editor. They'd be working with her, alongside her, handing her film trims and, you know, going to get shots and stuff, retrieving shots. It's so different now. But.
I always remember all the editors and Thelma's staff had a great sense of humor. There was a lot of frivolity.
I, like I.
It's like his own little club.
Right. You like to think that there would be because it's such a, unlike being on set, it's such an intimate environment where the director comes in and he or she has just been through this big battle.
Right.
This war, they're coming off from a war zone and they just need to be kind of protected and nurtured and supported. And, you know, I'm lucky that I have great people working with me. It would be pretty horrible if, you know, the director came in from the front lines and you know, had to put up with stuff in the editing room, you know, like that you don't want, you know. Sometimes we have to put up with things with certain directors and stuff like that, or producers, but it can't be the other way around, otherwise we're in trouble, you know.
So one thing I noticed, like when I was doing research for the Trailblazing Women, the word that kept coming up again and again was that all the great director editors have emotion, are very emotional people themselves, and that they put that emotion into
all the great directors?
All the great editors.
Editors, okay.
People would say, like when I was looking up, you know, Dee Dee Allen, they'd say, she was so emotional. She'd say, how are your children? How are you, you know, and when I think of Thelma, she's like a mother hen.
Very
sweet to,
You
know, there's never any yelling in the editing room. I mean, never. I always saw like a very kind of loving, like I said, humorous frivolity and a real sensitivity to the needs of the director.
You know, I've been fortunate in that, in my experience, it's been that. It's been nurturing. It's been, you know, it's been, there's been a lot of laughs, a lot of wit, and it's been mostly ideal, especially, you know, after I kind of had a big break with Whiplash. It's been a dream come true. But there, you know, there are. It's funny. You don't think of editors this way, but there are stories of editors, certain editors having tempers.
Yeah,
editors,
DPs.
You maybe think of it more because DPs tend to they have to be a little more alpha because I think they're on the set with that huge crew.
Yeah.
Editors, by definition, are expected to be more invisible and you know, just. Just more quiet, but there are some editors who have reputations, you know, in the past for, you know, there were some editors who would throw splicers when we cut film. They'd throw splicers at assistants. There were editors who, you know, I think like anything else, but that's, but I guess that just is another thing that shows you what we think of editors as, you know, because I think the biggest thing I think of is that, you know, not only do you have to be, hopefully you're a good editor, but you know how to put pieces of film together, but I think it requires you have to be a diplomat. It requires a certain amount of diplomacy because you have to try to push the ball down the field, you know, but in a way that doesn't feel like you're doing it out of your own ego.
Right.
You know, it has to be about the film, and you're often, an editor's often in between the studio and producers and the director, and is a liaison, but sometimes you get in between for political reasons and you have to kind of navigate it. So I when I talk to like aspiring editors now, I talk about how, yes, you have to know how to edit, but you also have to know how to be a human being. You have to know how to, you have to be social. You have to know how to interact with people.
Right.
You can't be a nebbish who's merely a good editor. You have to relate to people. You have to have a life and be a human being in a way. So,
So I have to, of course, ask about I mean, like you said, you were doing editing, but then Whiplash comes along, and that's you know, showy editing. But you told actually a really interesting story about the end of the movie, that even in the midst of the showy editing, it didn't quite work because you needed close-ups, and then you went back.
I think it all comes back to performance. I mean, Damien Chazelle, the director, is so prepared when he goes into a movie. I mean, Whiplash, he storyboarded himself. He had these crude drawings to storyboard, and for the musical scenes, he even made his own animatic little movies to show how he wanted it cut. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, great, I'll match all of that. And I tried to match it as best I could and based on how he shot it. And we looked at the first cut, and it was horrendous. It was awful. I mean, it was just, it was mechanical. Right. And it only worked when we found the right places to put the characters, found the right places to insert the looks. And was so we realized that, okay, we have a good basis, you know, we have good material, mm-hmm. There's no soul. And you get the soul from the performances. So we worked on trying to show the character of Fletcher, played by J.K. Simmons. We tried to show his character arc. So at the beginning of the scene, he's completely taken by surprise. He's humiliated. He's angry. And you had to show that arc go from that place to the end of the scene where mm-hmm. he's elated that he's found his buddy Rich, his own Charlie Parker. And similarly, you know, Miles Teller, we had to show him start at a place of angst and anger and then take him to that place where he's completely elevated and it's almost like a moment from The Matrix or something where he's like realized that he's making history. Mm-hmm. And so we had to track those two arcs and show those two how those two arcs relate to each other. And that's not something that was in the storyboards or it was only something that was generally in the script. Those little specific things with the eyes looking at each other, that's stuff we just had to like build in the cutting room. And Damien and I did that together.
Yeah, that's a great scene to look at if anyone is interested. So when you start a movie, do you start at the beginning? Do you get all the footage? You know, yeah. Lindsay Klingman told me, yeah. She's the editor of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah. She had to, he wanted to shoot the whole movie.
Right.
She never looked at a scene.
Right.
Until it was done.
Right, right.
And then she had to start with it.
From scratch.
Yeah.
That happens sometimes. That happens. It's different, you know, for different directors. The normal standard thing is that the editor starts when they start principal photography. Mm-hmm. And that's something that they, I don't remember what studio started that, but that's something that started back in the old studio days. Mm-hmm. And they did that so that they could have a cut ready right when principal ends, pretty close. And so that's usually what I do. Mm-hmm. A week after principal photography is done, I'll have a first cut of the movie. You really try to keep up with camera. And one reason for doing that is so that you can spot any potential issues or problems. So, or I can spot them, or the director or producers can say, pick up the phone and say to me, hey, can you do a quick cut of this scene? We're a little worried.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of improv or something like that. And and thankfully, you know, I haven't, with Damien's stuff, I haven't gotten too many of those calls, you know. But here's the thing about Damien and other directors are like this too. They don't, when they're shooting, they really don't like to look at cut stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because it really distracts them, and I think they feel like maybe it breaks their, they don't want to break their mojo, you know. David O. Russell, I think, is kind of the same way. Like mm-hmm. He's in his head for shooting and doesn't really want to see stuff cut, you know.
Right.
He'll communicate with you. He'll call you all the time from set, and he'll want to tell you what he shot and what he's thinking about it. But he doesn't want to get into that yet. And some directors will not want to watch a first cut that an editor does.
Right.
Because it's too overwhelming. Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Getting the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, just thinking about it, right? Yeah.
I've been a part of certain movies that have been like cut and recut and recut and destroyed and put back together. And, you know, To Die For is a perfect.
That's, I love like that movie. I'm a big fan of that movie. It's great.
There needs to be a criterion. You know, there's reels of it that aren't in the movie.
Oh, is that
and
right?
It was almost shelved at one point.
Wow.
Yeah, it was almost shelved. And then they had to literally re-edit, start from scratch. I've seen 10 versions of that film.
Okay, wow.
I saw one version where I wasn't even in the movie.
Wow. I love
that
it.
Was not a, I love that it. Was not a pleasant...
No, no.
Was it a good... Did you ever have an actor walk up to you and give, hey, Tom, thanks.
Yeah, no. It's a funny introduction to actors who work on these films because, as an editor, I'm so invested in what the actors do and their performances. I watch every nuance. I get to know. I feel like I get to know the actors intimately, and if I've never met them, the first time they come in the cutting room, I feel like I'm meeting like a long lost loved one.
Yes.
And they have no idea who I am.
Yeah.
They look at me and like, oh, hello. You know, there's a moment of like, it's a weird like, moment where I am overly familiar with the person, and I always have to remind myself, okay, they don't know who I am. It's okay, you know. But in terms of actors coming up to me afterward, there's a thing on Whiplash where, the Whiplash was a short film first.
Yes.
They did a short because no one would put up the money for it. So they did the short film, and they only got the money for the feature when it won an award at Sundance, the short.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but in the short film, there's a line when J.K. Simmons is berating the character of Andrew, and he says something along the lines of, what does he say? I don't know if I can say this or the language.
Yes, you can.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
so he in the short he says, if you don't do this, I'm gonna fuck you like a pig,
mm-hmm.
and that's not what the original line was. The original line was, it was something having to do with, I don't know why I'm blanking on it, but it was something having to do with, it wasn't like I'm going to fuck you like a pig. It was like I'm going to, something. It wasn't like I'm going to fuck you like a pig. It was going to something with a pig.
Right.
It'll come to me. And he said the line and sorry. He said, I'm going to gut you like a pig.
Okay.
Okay. And that's actually the line that, later on was used in a trailer. I'm going to gut you like a pig.
Right.
I'm going to gut you like a fucking pig. And so J.K. Simmons flubbed it once, and he said, I'm going to fuck you like a pig. And Damien and I thought, well, that sounds much worse than I'm going to gut you like a pig.
Right.
And so we used that take in the short. And all went well. We got the financing for the feature film. Damien adjusted things in his feature script to match what worked in the short. So he changed that piece of dialogue to, I'm going to fuck you like a pig if you don't do this. And J.K., when they came to shoot the scene, he's like, wait a minute, what is going on? He's not going to say this. This is crazy. And so he wouldn't say it. And he just said the original line, which is like, I'm going to gut you like a pig.
Yeah.
So when we're editing the feature film, we didn't have J.K. saying it, but we had it in the short. So we took the audio from the short and put that in because it just...
Love it.
It just...
Yeah.
It just worked. It's just... It was so... Such a horrifying, terrible thing to say.
Yeah.
And so later on... I don't remember. I think it may have been somewhere at the Governor's Ball or something.
Yeah, after he won his Oscar.
Yeah, J.K. came up to me. He's like, you had to do it, didn't you? You had to put that line back in. All right, buddy. And we kind of had a chuckle about it. He was okay with it, but it was,
As you clinked your Oscars together.
Right. Exactly. I was... He didn't stay too close to me for very long because I had come down with a cold after that whole. I was working at the same time as that whole awards run and then doing all the press and all the stuff. I was completely sick as a dog. Somehow I pulled it together for that night, but I was completely like.
Well, Whiplash was really a game changer because it really was like that was one of the highlights of the movie is the editing. I mean, it really.
I was very lucky because it was when. When I was trying to get into editing, I'm such a film geek. That's the sort of editing style, and that's the sort of movie that I would have loved and gravitated towards. So, to get that script and to get a director who wanted to tell the story through the editing was like that was like a dream come true. And I mean, we had the craziest post schedule on that. I mean, they started shooting in September, and we had to submit a cut to Sundance in early November, like the first week of November. Jesus. And then we locked picture of Whiplash in the first week of December.
Wow.
And it played in January. And that's it. It was the fastest post schedule for a feature I've ever had.
So I guess, and does that mean you're just working on instinct? Like you can't, you just go, yeah, this take works? Or is there very limited footage?
You know what? Damien, I don't know how he did this, but he got the pieces that he needed. And it was a very modest movie, $3 million budget, mm-hmm. And I think they shot 20 days or something. But so some of the scenes had very limited coverage. But then some scenes had a ridiculous amount of coverage. I mean, some scenes had more coverage than I get on much larger movies. Like the end scene, the slates, the letters went around the alphabet a couple times for the last final scene. Wow. I think we went into CA, which, amazing. And they were shooting two cameras, so that's double the amount of, anyways, just to say that there were so many setups for that. And that's on a little indie movie. So he's such a great filmmaker because he knows, he'll talk the talk in terms of, I want to do this for editing, I want to do that, but he'll actually get the pieces, mm-hmm. you know. Which strikes me a little bit, probably like you would know, Martin Scorsese. It strikes me as like he is.
Trust me.
You know, there's he knows the pieces angle. He wants to get.
Yeah, there's every angle. But then again, there's also funny things like mistakes. He loves mistakes. If the license plate fell off in Goodfellas, they leave it in.
Right.
They think it's hysterical.
Right.
As to quote Mr. Scorsese, continuity is for pussies.
It is. It really is. And you can see that in his movies when you see Paul Sorvino, they have a conversation and someone's got the cigar and then the glass is half full and half empty. It doesn't matter.
He doesn't care. Remember Cape Fear with my shirt and it's open. And
it's closed. And
he used to get, so angry.
Right.
Because he'd say, she's nervous. She establishes she's nervously unbuttoning everything, right. And then but it's a mistake. It's like it's open, it's closed, but they don't care about stuff like that.
Doesn't
matter. it sort of frees you up. So then after how long after Whiplash did you go into La La Land? Did you do a movie in between?
I did.
It's like a palate cleanser, and then you go back to
right. What did I do in between? Somewhere in between, I did Joy. I did the movie Joy for David O. Russell, and that was an amazing experience. That was another great break for me. And that was a multiple editor situation. Mm-hmm. So we had four film editors on that.
Wow.
Working at the same time.
Now, was the finished film of that the finished film? Because that seems like there's to my eye, something seems off with that film, and it's the editing.
Well,
it feels like, is there storylines being dropped?
Well, there were because it was David wrote such a dense epic script.
Yeah.
And he shot an epic amount of material, all great material.
Right.
But it was something where there was a lot of stuff that ultimately I think they felt didn't work for the story that they were going for.
Right.
But he's amazing because he goes in and he knows what emotion he wants for a scene and for mm-hmm. the movie, but he'll get different shades of that emotion mm-hmm. and he'll give you a lot of different options. And it's very different than just merely improvising and hosing everything down and, hoping for something. He really has a vision for things, but he likes to have different options in the editing room. And so that's why you need a lot of editors to explore all these different things.
Right.
It was interesting. All the editors had worked with David before on previous films. I was the only one who hadn't. Mm-hmm. But I got the job because one of the producers, John Davis, had seen Whiplash, and he was a big fan, and he had just met Damien Chazelle, and he got my number from Damien mm-hmm. and sent me an email and said, I'm working on David O. Russell's next movie. Would you be interested in talking to him about it? And I just like leapt out of my skin to do that. I think that's something that is part of it was the schedule. I think, we had a tight schedule, like mm-hmm. a Christmas release, and there was a lot of things to explore and a lot of film. And so, more than having a lot of editors, I think it was probably just a very ambitious movie to begin with.
Right.
You know, there were so many amazing performance things that probably will never see the light of day.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, again, you know, a movie like Goodfellas, I think, because they'd take like a year.
Yeah.
They would edit it very slowly and carefully over a year. You know,
right.
Like, so when you hear these things like, we did it in 30 days.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how they do things now.
It's both. Like, sometimes, I mean, my extreme example is Whiplash, which was like no time at all. And then, you know, La La Land was, I mean, we had like, I think I was working on that almost a year.
Yeah.
You know, from the beginning of shooting till the end of, you know, picture lock. I think that was a year.
So with La La Land, tell me the story about the opening scene was...
Right. The traffic number.
Right. That people saw versions of the film with it in and people saw versions with it out. I cannot imagine without it.
Well, this, you know, it was always designed to have this traffic sequence open the movie. But the other thing that was supposed to go along with that was a very retro opening title sequence. There was going to be an opening title sequence set against a palm tree background. It was going to start at night, and it was going to go through different times of day. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be a very painterly, almost fantastic view of this palm tree of LA sky. Mm-hmm. And it would go through all the credits. And it was supposed to be like a vintage movie. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to serve as an overture. So we had Justin Hurwitz's beautiful score going underneath and going through all the different melodies and changes. And after this 2.5 minute, 3 minute overture, we then were supposed to go to, the camera was going to pan down from this palm tree onto the traffic in Los Angeles, wide shot of the freeway, cars bumper to bumper. And then the camera moves in on Ryan Gosling, and he's playing around with his tape deck. It moves over to Emma Stone's car. She's reading her sides. And then the camera pans over, and all these these strange people jump out of their cars and start doing this musical number. Mm-hmm. And then at the very end, they slam their doors in unison, and then we go back to reality, and horns start honking, and then we cut to Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, and he's honking at her and stuff like that. So that's actually how it was originally designed. But when we screened the movie, that musical scene, first of all, the opening was way too long.
Yeah.
Which is important.
And when you say way too long, is that because you are sitting in the audience and you can feel people being restless?
Yes.
Yes.
And Damien and I, even just us watching it, we could feel restless ourselves. But, you know, not only, and maybe more frightening than that, was the scene itself just felt like it didn't belong in the movie. It was very strange to see Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone and then all of a sudden leave them and go to these people who look like they were from, like a Benetton ad or something, you know, like, I don't know, you know, dancing around. It felt like a different movie.
Yeah.
And then at the end, we go back to him, because then you start thinking, well, wait a minute, why isn't Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, why aren't they in the number? Why aren't they singing? It felt completely like a detour. And so we loved the so-called overture, and we loved that so much that we said, you know what, the traffic number is just not working. So we cut out the musical number part of it. We still introduce Ryan and Emma. They honk at each other, and that's the extent of it. And so we even previewed. We had a recruited preview screening where we did not have the traffic number in there. And the preview went pretty well. But what we realized was that taking the traffic number out was kind of disastrous because, first of all, it meant that we didn't have much of an opening. I mean, introducing Ryan and Emma with them honking at each other, it wasn't very cinematic. It wasn't like how Damien likes to start a movie. He's of the mind that, you know, your second best scene should be the first one in the movie, and your best scene should be the end. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it really was a nothing opening. And also, it meant that the first musical number was 15 minutes into the movie mm-hmm. with the roommates.
Right.
And that was just not designed to be the first number. You know, so we're sitting here watching the movie, and all of a sudden these Emma Stone and her roommates start singing and dancing, and it feels completely bizarre. Mm-hmm. It just throws you out of it. It was way too late to announce that it was a musical. So we had to do, basically, we had to find an editorial solution. So the first thing we did was we actually made the decision to drop the overture. Mm-hmm. So no credits at the beginning, no names, just start on the traffic number. And what we did is, and this actually took a little engineering, re-engineering, because it was not designed this way. If you remember, the scene is designed as like to look as if it's a single shot.
Right.
It was supposed to be like four interlocking pieces that you know are melded together, look like one shot. So we actually had to take, we ended up taking like the, you know, like the, like the, you know, last piece and move. We kind of moved mm-hmm. that to the front and stuff like that. So, or I should say, we took the first piece and moved that to the end. So the way it's configured now, the movie basically just begins on the sky mm-hmm. after we come out of a CinemaScope logo.
Right.
And then the camera pans down and we're on this wide shot of the traffic. And so the scene begins big. Then we start the number.
Yeah.
There are these strangers, but it's okay because we still are settling into the movie. We mm-hmm. don't know what this is. And on that last downbeat, when they slam their doors in unison, we decided to cut to the title, La La Land. And that comes up almost like as a moment to separate that front end from
right.
from what comes next. That disappears. That title disappears. Then we move in on our main characters. Mm-hmm. And it's funny now watching the movie because it seems so obvious, but that's not how it was designed.
Yeah.
You know, before we met the characters, then went away from them, and then came back to them. Mm-hmm. So our fear about losing the main credit sequence was that we would lose our so-called overture. But the way we reconfigured the traffic scene, that became our overture.
That is the overture.
It is. So
well, yeah, because even with the horns become like horns.
Right.
Tuning up and
that's right.
You
right.
know, it,
yeah.
So it is like an old fashioned.
It is like an orchestra. You exactly. know, getting ready and yeah, and once you put that title there, I mean, it's yeah. funny. This is editing. The devil's in the details, right? So even just putting that main title, when you hear that last downbeat and the door slam, that. You know, was something that separated the so-called overture, the traffic number, from the rest of the movie, and all of a sudden it felt okay that these characters were unimportant and they weren't
yeah.
people who recurred later. But we had to just try it, you know.
Yeah.
But it almost didn't make it into the movie.
I know.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I would have been very upset. So some other, of course, things that I love about the movie, you've got some very long scenes, but then
yes.
you know, beautifully cut montages. I love montages.
Right.
Of
me
course.
Too. Yeah.
Are you excited to get to? No one does montages anymore.
I love. I know. I love those. I mean, we had that was another thing with editing. We had to.
Did you look at each montage like, okay, we were lyrical here, so this one's going to be this
yes.
way.
Yeah.
So you had to
do yeah. Damien really wanted to try to do different styles, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, and hopefully, you know, the hope was that the movie could contain all those and have it not feel schizophrenic, but
right.
he did want to do different sort of styles and different cutting speeds, and he knew that he was going to do a lot of long takes,
mm-hmm.
and so he didn't want it to be a long take movie. Necessarily. So he knew that if you have long takes in this moment, you're going to have quickly cut stuff later
right.
to balance it out, you know, because he's a believer in contrast to enhance what's there.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the montages, you know, like this quick cut montage where they're running around LA, he always knew it was going to be this, you know, an LA montage, like a love letter to
right.
Hollywood. You know, we just kind of worked with Justin Hurwitz's score there and just tried to line up, you know, all this beautiful stuff he shot. He actually shot some pickups to fill in a couple blanks mm-hmm. montage-wise. But one montage that really was not designed or I should say it evolved in the editing, was a scene that I actually had my assistant editor work on with Damien, and he did my assistant did an amazing job. And it's the scene early on where Emma Stone and her roommates go out on the town, and they end up at a Hollywood party, and there's a big pool, and it's bombastic.
Trust me, I've seen the movie.
Right, so you know. You've lived that. You've lived that experience.
I said I watched it on the airplane. I'm like, am I going to watch this again? Okay.
Right, there we go. So it, so that scene was there's a moment in it where we do a very classical kaleidoscopic montage where you see neon signs and it's all kind of mashed together in this one graphic visual thing. And that's something that, you know, Damien wanted to do. He wanted to sort of replicate these kind of Slavko Vorkopich montage-y things from old Hollywood cinema. And so, but that was only supposed to be a transitional thing. That was supposed to last a couple seconds, and then we were going to transition into the party where we would have these long takes following the women walking through the party, and then Emma Stone would the camera would hand off from partygoer to partygoer, and the camera would finally wind up on Emma Stone, and she'd be sitting on this couch uncomfortable, and some guy would sit down to hit on her. There was no dialogue. It was always silent. But there'd be these long takes, take after take, you know, section after section, and it was too long. And it was a lot of the camera moves spent too much time away from Emma Stone. They were on these other characters, and they were beautiful camera moves. It was totally, it was like modeled after I Am Cuba, you know, a lot of I Am Cuba moving camera, but we lost the character. And so what we ended up doing was taking some of that party and folding it into that neon sign montage. So if you watch the movie now, you see, you know, you see these neon signs come up that suggest that they're driving out for a night on the town. You see dancing feet, you know, and you see champagne being poured. But then you also see Emma's face as she sits down on the couch and is at this party.
Right.
A guy sits down. And so all this little information we were able to kind of fold into this graphic montage. And we were able to do that because Damien had sort of set the table with this device, and so we were able to shorten the party itself just to the most important parts. And it was really important that Emma Stone's face was large enough in the screen in this multiple image thing. It was important that you registered her her face, because at the beginning of the montage she's running around with the women happy that they're going out for a night in the town. By the end of the montage, when she goes into the bathroom and looks at herself in the mirror, she's completely dejected. It's a totally different emotional place.
Yeah.
And so you needed the building blocks in between it. But the montage allowed us to do it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a great sequence. Another, of course, the ending is an amazing, another editing sequence of where she sees her life sort of flash before her eyes. I think, you know what I admire about the movie is that you got away with so many things that other people have tried to do and haven't really been successful. I think that everyone has kind of tried to do something like...
like a musical or like an old-fashioned musical in some ways.
I love the movie from the very beginning, but where I really love the movie and knew it was something special is when she's having dinner with her the guy she supposedly is engaged to, and she hears the music and it goes through the speaker and then it's a cut and then she's running. That I was like, that's different, because that's incorporating the emotion and the music in a seamless way.
Right. I mean, that's something Damien always wanted to do. And you know, I'm still amazed that the movie kind of works the way it does, or that a lot of people seem to be touched by the movie and really like the movie, because it is such a... in a way a narrow runway to land on, you know, because Damien wanted to get that right balance between having it be retro but not something ancient that you're going to hang in a museum wall. You wanted it to feel modern, accessible and contemporary.
That's what I meant when I said he pulls things off, like, oh, I'm gonna do the champagne glass, you know.
Right. Like, he can do that, which is ancient. That should be, yeah.
And I've seen other people trying to
do that. The kids these days should look at that and be like, whoa, wait a minute. What am I? Yeah, I know.
Now, and then tell me about when you, the first, when she, the audition, the famous audition scene.
Yeah.
And where she, and that's all one take?
One take. The one where she sings is one take. Yeah. And that was live singing too. Some of the movie is pre-recorded vocals. Like most of the big numbers, like the Traffic number, pre-recorded vocal.
Right.
The John Legend concert, pre-recorded vocal. A couple scenes were live vocal. And the audition scene where she's singing, and it is truly a single take, that's Emma singing. And the scene where they're sitting at the piano, Ryan and Emma are doing a little duet,
yeah,
City of Stars duet, that's live vocal as well. Mm-hmm. Live vocals, well, but I think I can't remember if it's Justin Hurwitz doing the piano, but Ryan spent a lot of time practicing the piano, so.
I can tell. Yeah. It's another thing as an editor. Did you have any fear of when you're cutting dancing? Of course, I've done a little bit of dancing, and that is like a horror where you're like, oh, crap, they didn't mess that one up.
Yeah, they didn't get,
it's all one take. Like the scene after the party.
That's right. A lot of the scenes, I was lucky in a way. A lot of the scenes in La La Land were single takes, and I didn't, you know, I didn't really have to. Some of the things we do, some little, what I call faker in the bakery, where it's supposed to look like one take, and it's actually more than one take. But most of that stuff is single take, and I was lucky. I just had to cut the slates off and. Here's the take, you know.
Yes.
But like the scene, A Lovely Night, you know, Griffith Park overlooking, you know, the valley lights and stuff like that. That's a single take. And that's one of my favorite scenes. And, you know, I almost want to, you know, whenever I've been asked to come and speak and show clips of La La Land, I'm very tempted to show that one scene. But I don't think I'm smart enough to talk about it being a single take, and people always want to see actual cutting, you know, but I'm always tempted to show the scene because I love the scene so much, and I love the scene because it's truly what's great about a musical, you know, narratively. At the beginning of the scene, the character, Ryan's character and Emma's character, they don't like each other. They're insulting each other. By the end of the scene, they're about to kiss.
Right.
So somewhere in between those two points, there was some sort of cinematic miracle happening,
yeah.
You know, and that was the dance and that was the music, you know, and, you know, I love that that's what you can do with a musical, you know, is that you can bridge the gap of these two very different emotions by having like a musical interlude, you know,
yeah.
And somehow like a mainstream audience, you know, and this happened with Singing in the Rain, with all the classic musicals, somehow mainstream audiences would watch these almost experimental films and they would actually follow them. Mm-hmm. Like they would function, which is very, Damien and I always thought that was really kind of funny in a way that you could take this very strange genre and it's a genre that was so mainstream at some point. But if you really look at the mechanics of it, it's using a lot of experimental devices.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre and avant-garde, you know? But that was one of my favorite numbers, and you know we had to decide whether to put taps in there for Ryan's tap dancing, and that was a big. Remember, we all had a big debate about that when we were sound editing and when we were on the dub stage.
Yeah.
And because there were some people, some producers, and people thought, you know, he's not wearing those shoes. He shouldn't be tapping. You know, and if he's wearing those shoes and he's tapping, why is it that when he walks away you don't hear any taps or he's, you know, anyways, I don't know. I just think like that's such a magical thing to have the taps. I mean, is anyone really going to take it so literally?
Right.
So I love the touch. So now when you hear it, you do hear some, there are some taps in it. Subtle, but there's some taps.
No, I think you have to.
I think you have to. I feel like you're leaving money on the table if you're doing a scene like that and you don't have the taps.
Definitely. You'd be the other half of the people would be like me going, where are the taps?
Where are the taps? Exactly.
Anyway, well, thank you so much for being here. It's such an amazing
thank you for having me.
Film. And what are you working on? What are you cutting right now?
Well, I just recently finished a movie for Scott Cooper. Mm-hmm. It's a Western called Hostile. So I went from one old Hollywood genre, the musical, to yes. another old Hollywood genre, the Western. So that stars Christian Bale and Rosamund Pike. And that's supposed to come out this December.
Uh-huh.
So that's completely different from La La Land. It's very grim and dark. I don't know if you know some of Scott Cooper's movies, Out of the Furnace, Black Mass. It's very dark. But I like to think it has an uplifting kind of ending that brings it all around. But and I also did some work on another musical called The Greatest Showman, mm-hmm. Which is with Hugh Jackman. And Hugh Jackman plays P.T. Barnum, and that's a movie for Fox, directed by Michael Gracey. That's coming out Christmas Day. And I have a couple weeks off, and then I start Damien's next movie, which is a movie called First Man. Mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling plays Neil Armstrong. Oh. So I'm about to jump back into cutting room.
Would he wait for you to make a movie? Like, is it that vital? I mean, obviously, there's a reality.
I hope I never have to ask him. I hope I never have to beg him to do that, but I don't know if he'd ever have the choice, but I would love that. I've told this to Damien. I mean, if he wants to direct the phone book, I want to like be editing it, you know, so whatever he wants to do, I'm on board. And, I heard a story about, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's editor, George Tomasini, who cut Psycho and many other movies. I mean, supposedly Hitchcock would wait for Tomasini.
Yeah, I can see.
But I don't think that happens that often. So I don't know. Hopefully that won't get tested.
No, I think it's vital. Well, if I have any say so.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for being with us, Tom. It's been amazing.
Thank you guys.
And you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, in bookstores and on Audible. Also, check out our Facebook page, and the website is ileanaspodcast.com.
That's right. And as we always say, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is the end of our movie for today. Thank you so much, Tom.
I love it. Thank you.
Thanks
have a great everybody.
Day.
Bye.
Thank you.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.